Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, an update on abstinence-only miseducation in light of the recent congressional hearings, more on universal health care, and an interview with Dr. Dana Stone about a recent bill in Oklahoma. Also, John Gibson can't argue with Rachel Maddow, so he lamely calls her a lesbian. The thinking world responds, so what if she is? Is something lost in translation with this story reported by Keith Olbermann?
For women in her conservative nation, Ecuadorian Assembly member Maria Soledad Vela has introduced a bill that would ensure the pursuit of sexual happiness. Ms. Vela claims the right to enjoyment will ensure women can make free, responsible, and informed decisions about their sex lives. An opposition member accused Vela of trying to decree orgasm by law, saying it, quote, isn't possible. Responds Assemblywoman Vela, I never asked for the right to orgasm, only the right to enjoyment.
Actually, it seems much more of the reason for all the hyperventilating over the bill is not that women might have more orgasms, God forbid. According to the BBC, Vela's aim with the bill is to create the groundwork for women to have healthier, more responsible sex lives. In other words, she's trying to create a right to reproductive justice as much as anything else. Not so silly after all. Recently, as I'm sure you know, my home state's beloved comprehensive sex education activist Shelby Knox testified in front of Congress about what a massive failure abstinence-only education is. It fails our kids on various levels, from failing to protect their health to failing to be honest and kind and decent to them, a failure that's much harder to measure but just as serious. Well, let's let Shelby talk.
The same pastor who officiated at my religious pledge ceremony also presented a secularized abstinence-only program to students in my school district. Many students were already having sex and needed information to protect their health. However, he expounded on the ineffectiveness of condoms, explaining in graphic detail and with even more graphic pictures the sexually transmitted infections one could get if we trusted our health to a flimsy piece of latex.
Abstinence-only education is based on what is best described as a lie. They get the funding by saying that this is about keeping kids from getting sick, and then proceed to try to encourage already sexually active students to get sick. You can't tell me that telling kids not to use condoms isn't directly aimed at getting kids not to use condoms, which is a direct road to pregnancy and disease. I hate to accuse anyone of trying to get kids sick or pregnant to punish them for having sex, but sometimes the evidence is just stacked that high. As Shelby is about to describe, the contempt that abstinence-only proponents have for people, well, women really, who have sex outside of marriage is such that it's easy to believe that they want us to suffer miserably for being so disgusting.
He also touched on the ills of masturbation and warned against homosexual sex. One demonstration he used left little doubt as to our worth as a future spouse or partner or person if we were to engage in sexual activity before marriage. He pulled an often squirming and reluctant and always female volunteer onto the stage, took out a toothbrush that looked like it had been used to scrub toilets, and asked her if she would brush her teeth with it. When she predictably refused, he pulled out another toothbrush, this one pristine in its original box, and asked her if she would brush her teeth with that toothbrush. When she answered in an affirmative, he turned to the assembly and said, if you have sex before marriage, you are a dirty toothbrush.
How does someone get involved in abstinence-only miseducation? Well, some people just love to lie, I guess. Some people have massive sex phobias that should be a cause for concern, but instead get all this social acceptance because they have a place in religious dogma. Misanthropy seems to be a common thread. Abstinence-only miseducators seem to get off on humiliating and hurting teenagers in their classrooms. You have the ones who like wagging a dirty toothbrush at a girl and implying she's a dirty slut. And you have the ones who like to rip tape off kids or dangle bricks over their genitals. And then they give them information that will get them pregnant or an STD. All under the guise of caring. If you want to be chilled to the bone, check out a video of abstinence-only educator Pam Stenzel. Sadistic lying is raised to an art form with this woman, and when she says that she's flown around the world spreading her lies, I felt sick.
If you have sex outside of one permanent monogamous, and monogamy does not mean one at a time. That means one partner who has only been with you. If you have sex outside of the context, you will pay. No one has ever had more than one partner and not paid.
No one has been in a monogamous relationship and not paid. No one has gone on a date and not paid. Even if your date pays for dinner, you probably paid for the nice clothes and makeup you wore. People who believe in the abstinence-only line are being set up to pay a lot. If you believe sex makes you dirty, a normal breaking up and moving on process is probably 100 times worse. And then she encourages teenage girls to have babies. No, I'm not kidding.
What do you think most teens who are having sex are afraid of? It's their biggest fear. Pregnancy is the biggest fear of teens having sex today. Doesn't make a bit of sense to me. Got a newsflash for you. Pregnancy's not a disease. It's survivable. You can actually live through it. I've lived through it 3 times now. A few extra pounds here and there. It hasn't killed me yet.
This is a favorite piece of anti-choice propaganda, that pregnancy isn't a disease. Once again, they replace semantics for meaning. Evolution is a theory, sure, but that doesn't mean it's just a theory. And unplanned pregnancy isn't a disease, but neither is a broken leg. She lists off a bunch of STDs, but of course isn't about to tell you that you can avoid most of them through safer sex practices, and that many of them, despite their alarming names, are probably not the stress and misery factor that unplanned pregnancy presents. You know, you're pregnant and you don't plan to be. You have a soul-searching choice about whether or not to abort ahead of you. Most people don't soul-search about whether or not to take the penicillin. She then moves on to lying to girls in order to get them pregnant, by telling them that birth control is dangerous, though of course she's pretending that pregnancy is a walk in the park. But hey, the pro-choice side is getting our narrative into the mainstream media. And The Daily Show, which covered what they call the global war in your pants.
All right, any other objections? Senator Brownback, this is a nationwide problem. Some perspective, please.
The current culture pushes against what we try to teach in the Brownback family.
Yes, in the Brownback family, we teach that boys have a God stick and girls have a shame cave. And then we never speak of them again. You might think having sex or not having sex are your only two options.
But there is a third way.
An awesome way.
They call it dry humping.
Bumping zippers.
Clapping corduroys.
Skunk blasting.
Yeah. It's grinding your genitals together with clothes on.
It's fun and safe, and you can still get into heaven.
Plus, no disgusting condoms.
Hey, just don't let mom do your laundry tonight.
Dry humping!
I feel better already. I'd like to welcome Dr. Dana Stone to the program. Dr. Stone is an Oklahoma-based physician and the chair of the state's branch of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's here today to talk about some recent anti-choice legislation that was railroaded through the state legislature with very little room for dissent. Dr. Stone, can you explain the details of this ultrasound and signage law and why it's so bad for doctors and the patients that they serve?
Yes, this bill was a pretty comprehensive bill that incorporated several separate bills, and it ended up affecting RU 486 prescriptions that gave a conscientious objector status for healthcare providers. It required a sign to be placed that no one could force you to have a termination of pregnancy in abortion clinics. Most of those things we thought were fine, and they just kind of restated pre-existing law. But the ultrasound part of the bill we really had problems with. And under the guise of informed consent, they require either an abdominal ultrasound or a vaginal probe ultrasound, and the bill states whichever gives the clearer image. So that doesn't allow the woman to choose the route of the ultrasound, and it doesn't allow the physician to choose the route of the ultrasound. basically has the state legislature mandating a medical test. It requires starting at a $10,000 fine up to $100,000 or more for physicians who do not comply with this, and they can lose their medical license if they don't comply with this. It really was kind of railroaded. It seemed like all of these bills started out as Senate bills, and then when it got to the House side, they combined them so that when it got back to the Senate, they could not amend it at all. They either just had to vote yes or no. In Oklahoma, the climate is such that the state legislators are so convinced that their constituents are very pro-life, and they are all afraid to vote against anything like this, no matter how bad it is. So there were it required 17 state senators to block this, and we only had initially 10 votes against it. The governor ended up vetoing the bill, and he needed, again, 17 votes in the Senate to sustain his veto, and he picked up one. They ended up with 11 votes to sustain the veto. So the House and Senate both overrode his veto, and it becomes law November 1st.
So how does this bill harm patients?
Well, it takes away their autonomy. When doctors and nurses get their medical training, one of the very first things, most important things that they teach us is that we are there for the benefit of the patients, and patients always have the ability to refuse any treatment options that we give them, you know, even if we think it's in their best interest, even if they will die without the treatment that we're suggesting for them. So the idea that the state is mandating a test that's not really in the woman's best interest at all, and she has no right to refuse it and still proceed with the termination that she's there for, is just against, you know, all of the things that we ever learn about caring for patients.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, I have to say, that there's a sign that says nobody can force you to have an abortion, yet the state is forcing you to have an ultrasound.
Yeah, we thought so too. We thought that was pretty ironic as well. The other thing is that it's overkill in that there was already a law in place. 24 hours before a woman has her appointment for a termination of pregnancy, she is required to understand from the physician that there are places in the state that will do a free ultrasound for her. So the woman has already been required by state law to be offered an ultrasound at no cost to her. And she's also been required to get information either by a website or have it mailed to her home that details the development of a fetus, details the risks of doing a termination of pregnancy, and it was at least balanced enough that it detailed the risks of continuing a pregnancy as well. So there was already all kinds of information out there that gave a woman informed consent. This new law just mandates that she have this. They make a lot of the fact that they were kind enough to incorporate into the law that she may avert her eyes from the ultrasound. But the physician is required to give a detailed verbal explanation of what's on the screen. So even if she chooses to avert her eyes, she's supposed to distract herself from the fact that there's a probe in her vagina that she doesn't want there, and how she's supposed to not listen to what's being described to her. So they make a lot of the fact that they, you know, that this was an option for the woman, but doesn't hold a lot of water for me.
The obnoxiously high fines, do you think that there's an intention there behind these kinds of bills to put doctors out of business?
Oh, you know, I think all of these bills are trying to make the whole process more cumbersome for both the patient and the physician, more expensive for the patient and the physician. Ultrasound machines cost a lot of money. Even a small little portable one, when I looked at it for our office, cost $30,000, and the normal ultrasound machines that you see are close to $100,000. So, you know, they're just trying to make it cumbersome and expensive and embarrassing and doing everything short of banning it altogether, which they're not allowed to do because of the Roe versus Wade.
Isn't doing an ultrasound kind of part of the procedure before you actually perform the abortion, or am I mistaken there?
No, if you look at the American College of OBGYN recommendations and guidelines for termination of pregnancy, they suggest that an ultrasound should be available if required. But really, if you have a positive pregnancy test and you can tell on exam how far along a woman's pregnancy is, you know if she's in the right safe time to do the procedure that you plan to do. And if you have any questions, then yeah, an ultrasound is very helpful. And if the woman wanted the ultrasound to understand what was, you know, how far along the baby was or to see for herself, then that's fine too. But the idea that doctors need the state legislature to mandate for them and their patients that an ultrasound be done in every single instance is it's not medically indicated. It's not, it doesn't go along with our ethical treatment of patients to allow them to forego any treatment that we suggest to them.
You attempted to dissent publicly on this legislation before it was passed and inform the public why it's so bad, but your attempts were blocked. Can you tell the story of what happened there?
As soon as I read this bill and understood that it had passed the House quickly, I wrote a letter to the editor at the Daily Oklahoma, which is the main newspaper for the central and western part of the state. The Tulsa World is one that is more progressive and is read by people in the eastern part of the state. But for this part of the state, the Daily Oklahoman is kind of the mainstay, and it's pretty conservative. It's always been that way. And I heard back from whoever vets those letters, and they said, this has already been taken care of. It's too late to ask people to contact their legislators about this. But it was 10 more days before the Senate finally voted on that bill, so I don't know if they were misinformed or if they just didn't want to print the letter, but that was their reasoning for not printing my letter. There's a weekly alternative newspaper in Oklahoma City called the Gazette, and they printed a similar letter a week later, so that letter came out about the time that the Senate was voting to pass the bill the first time. And then the Gazette actually has run a front page this past Wednesday. They ran a front page article about the bill now that it's a done deal. So this is probably the first that most people are hearing very much about it is now that it's too late to do anything about it. One of the legislators that worked to pass this bill was quoted at the very end of their article, and she said, she's a very anti-choice legislator. She said this bill empowers women to make an informed decision about this life-altering procedure, and I thought that was pretty much of a misstatement to think that a bill that makes a requirement for an invasive procedure that a woman can't turn down was any kind of empowerment.
Yeah, it's kind of strange how they're like borrowing feminist language to push this sort of thing through.
Oh yeah, yeah. The other annoying thing about what this same group of people was trying to accomplish is that the state health department is making sure that women, no matter their immigration status, are going to get prenatal care, and they've started a new program for that. And just after this ultrasound bill passed that was so concerned about the unborn, they were trying to pass legislation to block the ability of women to get prenatal care.
For further coverage of the story, check out the coverage at Ms. Magazine, and Dr. Stone also put up articles at Huffington Post and Alternanet. Thank you so much for coming on to tell your side of the story, Dr. Stone.
Yeah, thank you for your interest.
Usually in the intersection of the politics of sexuality and the politics of healthcare, we like to talk about universal health coverage and access to reproductive health care. Especially when you come from a reproductive justice perspective, as I like to think I do, the question of coverage is central. But there's other places the issues intersect, as a recent story in the LA Times demonstrated. According to a survey conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 7% of Americans admitted that someone in their household married last year to obtain health insurance. it's probably not as severe an issue as it sounds. I'm sure most of the couples marrying for the insurance are in love. But still, it's a sign of the times, as this recent podcast by Dr. Mark Ringel gets at.
I always ask men who are my age what they did about the military draft that it was our generation's fate to face during the conflict in Vietnam. We all have our stories, either about service in the armed forces or about how we got out of it. I attended medical school during much of the period when I would have been draft bait, for example. There was no end to what some of my comrades did to avoid joining the Army. They volunteered to teach in inner-city schools, joined the National Guard, got doctors to write letters to the draft board about their asthma or football knee injuries, confessed to bedwetting, amputated their trigger finger, and even went so far as to get married. Today, the stories about what people do to obtain health insurance are beginning to sound like the tales my cohorts tell about their adventures with the draft board. And the stakes can be just as high, life and death.
Obviously, it's a problem that people are making decisions about marriage and work based around health care, which is limiting. I do worry that this trend will make conservatives less likely to embrace universal health care if they think it's a way to strong-arm the unwilling into marriage. Recently, Hillary Clinton submitted to a sit-down interview with Bill O'Reilly, and he tried to claim universal health care would bankrupt the country. I liked her reply, so I thought I'd share it with you.
If we don't get to universal health care, we will continue to bleed money. If we don't have more accountability, like through electronic medical records, we will never catch up to the fraud. If we don't make a decision right now that we're actually going to protect what is best about the American health care system, we won't recognize it in 10 or 20 years. So here's what I say. Everybody who has health insurance who's happy with it, you keep it. No changes. But what I am going to do is take an already existing plan. It's not government run. It's not a new bureaucracy. It's the way Congress and federal employees get their health care. And we're going to open it up to every American because I think it's about time.
But you're going to subsidize them.
Well, we are. And
yeah.
Here's why. You already are subsidizing it. Your family policy has a $900 hidden tax. Why? Because when some poor person who doesn't have health insurance...
Goes to the emergency room.
That's right.
You got to pick it up.
You pick it up.
I don't mind doing it.
Well, but we're going to get the cost down for everybody because people should pay something if they can afford to pay it. So under my plan, we're going to tell the insurance companies, no more discrimination. You got to take care of people with pre-existing conditions. We're going to regulate them differently.
Working in reproductive rights, it's really clear how universal health care would save money over the long run. I can't see a more straightforward version of how a penny of prevention spent on contraception and condoms prevents a hefty bill of cure for STDs and unplanned pregnancy. Why that kind of common sense is lacking in the debate is beyond me. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Lately, Rachel Maddow has been all over the TV, kicking butt and taking names and gaining fans. It was just a matter of time before desperate Wingnuts resorted to irrelevant attacks on her based on sexual orientation. John Gibson of Fox News went there. First, he played a clip of Maddow talking, and instead of addressing what she actually said, he did this.
That is...
Ooh, lesbian, yummy.
Did I tell you about the people on the island of Lesbos? Never mind.
I'm sure Gibson thinks we should all listen to what he has to say by virtue of what he does in bed with who.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.